Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Well, it's just a remarkable thing to realize, but we here at Your Weekly Constitutional have now been broadcasting for 5 years. Is that amazing? Since March of 2011. And over those 5 years, some very nice and very unusual things have happened. One unusual thing that really struck me is that once we started podcasting, which we do about a week after we broadcast each show, after we started putting our podcasts up on iTunes, I noticed a pattern developing, and it holds to this day. In any given week, we may have as many downloads in Britain as we have in the United States. And that's really remarkable. I know we all speak English and we have a common constitutional history, but the United States is a much larger country in terms of the number of people, certainly, that are in it. And yet our good friends in Britain listen as much as people in the United States do. So thank you, friends in Britain. We appreciate you. And we're just as curious about you as you are about us. So we're very, very happy that you're joining us each week. And beyond that, we have made some friends in Britain. We've made some friends specifically at the University of Northumbria at their law school. We have some law professors there by the name of William Walton and James Gray, who've been on the show before, and as you'll see, will shortly be on the show today. William will be, at least, along with one of his students, a young woman named Melissa Davis. It turns out that when we met William and James a year or so ago, they were on a scouting mission, and the scouting mission was to set up an itinerary to bring over, I guess, about 30 of their Northumbria law students, people who are studying the American Constitution and who wanted to come over where else to Virginia, where it all began and where so much constitutional history has taken place. And so during this trip, we took the opportunity, courtesy of our friends at WEHC at Emory and Henry College, Teresa Keller, Richard Grace, thank you so much for letting us use your wonderful, wonderful new facilities there. And we got William and some of his students, and we all sat down, and we had two hours worth of interviews. The first you're going to hear today, in which William and I and one of his students, Melissa Davis, who also happens to be a city councilor in Newcastle, talk about Brexit and talk about many different aspects of it. We'll finish that up probably. That was a long enough interview. That'll probably go into next week. And then we'll also pick up with our roundtable discussion next week with the British students. And the roundtable discussion involves a number of different topics, but it also eventually comes around to the proposed Brexit. So I'm calling these episodes Brexit Part 1 and Brexit Part 2. And without further ado, here is William Walton.
Oh, good morning, Stuart. I'm William Walton, and I'm a professor of law at the University of Northumbria, and I'm here with a group of students visiting the United States. We've been in Virginia for the last 3 or 4 days and enjoying it tremendously.
This is a long-anticipated trip. In fact, one we made reference to in one of our earlier episodes when we talked about the British Constitution, because you were already in town. And in fact, we talked twice. We talked once, didn't we, long distance? And then we've talked when you were in the country getting ready for this trip, and that was roughly a year ago.
That's correct. My colleague James Gray and I, we did a dry run for this trip. I think it was June of last year, and we ran into you in Johnson City in Tennessee, and we spoke then about the constitutional implications of, well, the fracturing of Britain, the European issue, and various other items. So, yes, we have met before.
One of your students has joined us. So who are you, and what do you do?
So I'm Councillor Melissa Davis. I'm a law student at Northumbria University, and I'm also a city councillor on Newcastle City Council, which is where the university is as well.
So you are actually a government official in Britain?
In opposition, yes. I stand for the Labour Party, and in government at the minute is obviously the Conservatives.
We were just talking before we started here, and I mentioned you were a government official, or I said you were one of Her Majesty's government officials. And you and Professor Walton had to immediately point out that, no, actually, you're in the opposition. And that's an interesting distinction we've already encountered. Anybody who's in elective office in the United States, we'd say, is a government official, regardless of party. But you make more of a distinction. You're either with the governing majority or you're against the governing majority. And,
yeah.
And Labour is definitely against the governing majority at the moment.
Yes, we definitely are, yeah.
I see. But if you win a majority, then you'd be part of the government.
Then it would be, yes.
I think I'm correct in saying that Labour do run Newcastle, don't
yes,
they?
Yes.
The majority party within Newcastle. So the city council is Labour-controlled.
Yeah, so we have control of the council. So I'm an official of the local council, but not the country as a whole.
That's just remarkable. Well, before we go any further, because I'm sure people are curious, you say you're a counselor. Is that something similar to what we have here? Is just a member of the city council? Or we have small representative bodies that are typically elected either at large or by districts. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes from that group, we have an executive officer chosen called a mayor, or sometimes the mayor is elected in a separate election. Does that sound similar to what you do in Newcastle?
Yeah, that's the same. So we have election. So I stood for election for a particular district. And then all of the districts make up the whole city council throughout with the members. And then from the members, we select a mayor from the members, rather than an elected one as an individual election.
Now, I have to comment here, because people can't see you, that you are a very young person.
Yes.
So you're already a member of the city council. Do you mind my asking how old you are?
I'm 23.
How in the world does a 23-year-old get elected to a city council of a major city?
I was 22 at the time, but I'd worked within the Labour Party for a long time from when I was 16. I had a year out before uni and worked full-time with MPs and things like that, so I'd always had experience and decided to stand last year.
And it worked?
Yeah.
My goodness. Are we looking at a future prime minister here?
Well, we could be. I was going to add that from my knowledge of American local government, you typically have 5 or 7 councillors or supervisors when you're even for large cities like Chicago. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think I'm correct in saying in Newcastle, well, Melissa, you could tell me, are there 50 or 60?
How many? We have 78 councillors for the city. 78, yeah.
So the districts are relatively small.
There's 26 districts and 78 councillors.
So this is mostly a deliberative body then?
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
And so you pass local ordinances, yep. Legislation, that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing?
Yeah.
And then is your mayor chosen from the council? Or?
Yeah, it's chosen from one of the elected members. It changes each year. Last year we had our 800 mayor of the city. So this year we've just
800th
chosen.
Mayor of the city.
Yep.
Another reminder that your history goes back a lot further north. I don't know if there's a city in the United States that has had even 100 mayors. I don't know. I guess there must be some, but certainly not 800, I would think. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Melissa, as
You're
well.
Welcome.
And Bill, I'm going to look back at you, because the original thought here was that you were going to give me an update on all sorts of really important constitutional issues. Of course, we're happy to have Melissa chime in as appropriate. In fact, you may have some very interesting perspectives mm-hmm. being a member of Labor. But there's some very significant things going on, from the potential that seems to have been momentarily averted of a Scottish secession, and also the seemingly more plausible idea of Britain's secession from the European Union. So tell me what's going on with all you crazy Britons over there.
Well, the two may be linked. We'll get onto that later on in terms of what could be the implication of Britain withdrawing from the European Union and its implications for Scotland. But yes, on the 23rd of June, in I think 75 days' time, we will have a nationwide referendum, which was promised by the Conservatives when they were in opposition. And that referendum is on the simple question as to whether the United Kingdom should or should not remain a member of the European Union.
And that is really a fundamental constitutional issue, because as we discussed in our previous discussions, when Britain joined the EU, to some extent, this was much more than just a treaty. This is more akin to some sort of federation that Britain was coming into. And to some extent, especially critics of the EU will say that Britain surrendered a certain degree of its sovereignty when it did so.
That is the argument, that mm-hmm. the United Kingdom joined what was then the European Economic Community in 1972. And in 1975, June of 75, there was a referendum as to whether the United Kingdom should remain a part of the European Union. And there was a 2-1 majority in favour of remaining a member. But the organisation that the United Kingdom joined at that time was presented as essentially a free trade organisation with a pretty small number of countries. We were the 9th country to join, and now there are 28. And of course, the remit of the organisation has expanded correspondingly. And for the cynics and sceptics, that really is their beef. That is their argument, that we are now part of an organisation which has hollowed out sovereignty in the United Kingdom, where most decisions are taken in Brussels, and where Britain is no longer really in charge of its day-to-day destiny, if I can put it like that. Now, that's the cynic's argument, or skeptic's argument. The people who support membership of the European Union would obviously take a would take a more positive view of that relationship.
But both the supporters and the opponents would probably agree that it was a gradual process, and that something that started out as sort of a trade union has morphed into something that's really much more of a political union and seems to be moving, or at least up until quite recently, in the direction of becoming sort of a super state, a United States of Europe, perhaps 100 years from now, if that process continues. Is that a fair statement, that more and more government and political control is going to Brussels, or at least has been over the last 40 years?
Well, I think probably the most important turning point in recent years was the introduction of the single currency.
Right, the euro, yeah.
And I think the argument is that if you lose control of your currency, then sovereignty means less and less. It doesn't mean much at all if you don't have your own currency, because without your own currency, you don't really have... You lose a centralized bank. You lose, therefore, the opportunity to really engage in monetary policy where you can change the supply of money, which is obviously a very powerful economic instrument for governments to have. And if they can't do that, so goes the argument. As I say, this is an extremist, and then what's the point of having a national government?
Yeah, very, very important thing to do. And we should note here that that's one exception that Britain has already carved out for itself, is that when you go to Britain, you're still negotiating business with British pounds.
That's correct. I think it was under the Conservatives and then under Labour, under Blair, but both governments made sure that Britain remained outside of the euro, didn't adopt the euro. And of course, what then unfolded in the early part of the 2000s was the collapse of part of the European economy, and many people then turned around and said, well, I told you so. It's a good thing that we never joined the single currency.
Because, of course, it was
a
good debate
out of Greece.
Yeah, it gave you a lot more control over your own destiny during the great financial crisis over the last decade or so.
Yes, and Germany is now essentially having to fund the bailout of some of the peripheral countries, and it's Germans who are perhaps paying the consequences of that single currency agreement. And increasingly, from what we understand, that is less and less popular within Germany. Mm-hmm. So this, as I think I said to you a year ago, this skepticism about the European Union is by no means limited to the United Kingdom, but it has greater force in the United Kingdom, perhaps because of our island, our geographical situation. So it has perhaps greater currency or greater momentum, but it does apply in other countries as well.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with William Walton, a law professor from Northumbria University in Newcastle-upon-Tyne in Great Britain, and his student, Melissa Davis, a city councillor in Newcastle, all about Brexit, the proposed exit of Great Britain from the European Union. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with William and Melissa. Stick around. And hey, now it's time for our constitutional quiz. This one was recorded at the high school state finals in the great Commonwealth of Virginia in 2016. And in addition to me and the quiz guy, Doug Smith, you're going to hear a third voice helping with the quizzes. His name is Cash Earhart. He works for the Sorensen Institute, a marvelous institution here in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And he was helping us out, being sort of the Oprah Winfrey guy out in the crowd, taking the microphone to the contestants.
My name is Jabril Colvin, and I'm from Brunswick High School. Go, Bulldogs!
Tremendous. And how many years have you been in We the People?
I guess you could call this the second one.
Second year?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Nice. Tremendous. Alrighty. Well, what do we got?
Sensational.
Sorry, what?
Sensational.
Sensational.
Yeah.
Tremendous. You're sensational. Okay, great.
Was that your answer? Because that's not one
that's
of my four.
That's not my answer.
Oh, yeah, okay. You were thinking he was jumping the gun.
For his word. That was my synonym.
So this one's a riddle. Do you want to explain the riddle?
The riddle is a riddle. You will have four choices.
Great. Here it comes. So I'm going to read it out, give you four choices. The riddle is a little longer. It's a little harder. It's more, you're from Brunswick. You should, it will not be a problem at all for you. Here we go. I'm all about speech, even though I'm usually silent. I have a proud wave, even though I have no hands. An appearance in Dallas really got me burning. But Justice Brennan didn't care if I offended others. What am I? Am I A, a podium? B, a politician? C, a flag? Or D, a campfire?
I'm going to say a flag.
A C. Flag? Answer yeah. choice C. What about a politician?
I don't know. They do have a nice little wave. Uh-huh. But they talk.
They do talk, don't they? Yeah, that's true. They do talk. Okay. They
some
talk
some of them are accused of talking too much.
I see.
Up like Trump.
What kind of flag?
The flag that's on the answer?
What's significant about this particular Supreme Court case and the podium, the politician, the flag, or the campfire?
Excuse me?
I think he just wants to know whether he won or not.
He won.
He won.
Yay, that's right.
Congratulations.
Oh, wait, wait,
congratulations.
Wait. We do want to go into a little bit more detail on this one. Who knows what case we're talking about?
Huh? Okay, right here.
Texas versus Johnson.
Texas versus Johnson. And what is your name, sir?
Jake Zaslav.
Chase?
Okay. Jake.
Jake, I'm sorry, Jake. That's right. You were in one of my sessions today, weren't you?
Yep.
Who's your favorite judge today?
Who's my favorite judge?
The scoring's already been turned
it's
in.
Cash.
Okay. Yeah! Okay. Here's a magnet!
Cash is the man who has the magnets. Okay, well done.
Texas v. Johnson.
Texas v. Johnson. What was significant about Texas versus Johnson?
It established that it's okay to burn the American flag, and that it's a form of free speech and a symbolic speech. And then it would also lead to several amendments being proposed to prevent flag burning from occurring. But those amendments wouldn't be ratified or passed by Congress.
Well done. Well,
well done,
done indeed. Okay.
Well done.
Go get a T-shirt. That's tremendous.
That's good.
There was a case later on, Colonel Sanders v. United States. He tried to argue that an American bald eagle roasted over a burning American flag was the most patriotic food you could eat. He lost the case 7-3. No, 7-2. Yeah.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today it's all about Brexit, the proposed exit of Great Britain. See how they got that Britain exit? You see that. The proposed Brexit that's going to be voted on later this year in June. And speaking with me today is William Walton, a law professor from Northumbria University in Britain, and one of his students, Melissa Davis.
And the constitutional issue, of course, is where is the power? Where is the power of the people? Where is the sovereignty? Are you really a separate and independent nation if you've given up too much control to some other entity, and especially if you've given control over your finances? Because money is simply one particular form of power, if there's one way to look at it. I must say that as a tourist a year and a half ago, I was very inconvenienced when I had to travel between London and Paris and had to exchange all my pounds for euros. So as a tourist, I see the value of having the euro. And of course, when I went on to Germany, it was very, very convenient. Every place you went, you were just using the same denomination. And of course, that's one of the main economic arguments for the euro, is that it makes business much easier. It simplifies things. You don't have to worry about exchange rates and all the rest of it. And so there are arguments pro and con. It's probably fair to say also, though, isn't it, that the European Union was growing stronger and expanding as long as things were going well. And it's really been since the financial crisis especially that there have been much more moves towards separatism, not just in Britain but elsewhere.
Well, as I said to you last time we spoke, the organization has moved from the economic core of Europe, mm-hmm. where all of the economies were of a similar nature, and the countries were of a similar nature. They were long-established countries, Germany and France and the Benelux countries. Mm-hmm. And as it expanded as an organization, it began to take in what one might call some of the peripheral countries of Europe, so the PIGS, as they were sometimes called, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, mm-hmm. And Ireland. And then, of course, the expansion into the former, I beg your pardon, actually, I think PIGS is, the I in PIGS is Ireland. But, mm-hmm. but Ireland and Italy and Greece and Spain and Portugal, these were all peripheral economies. And then, of course, it expanded into the former Soviet Union-occupied countries of...
Which are very different economies.
Very, very different economies. And, of course, their economies had been prohibited, really, from developing for 30, 40 years. And so overnight, the nature of the European Union changed absolutely dramatically. And that... That introduces, obviously, very real pressures and challenges, if I can put it that way, for the European Union.
Sure. All around, both political and monetary, and those strains have been showing lately. Okay. I think that sets up the big picture here. Since the last time we spoke, there was a referendum in Scotland on secession, or actually called devolution there, wasn't it? Or was it – what would you actually call it?
Well,
it was a referendum in just simply Scottish independence.
Yeah,
right?
be precise. Actually, it was that referendum took place before we spoke. It was in September 2012.
Okay.
So,
but there was talk of another one, wasn't there?
Yes, and there remains talk of another referendum. So, just to go back a step or two, the Scottish National Party, if I refer to them, the SNP,
right,
have always had it as really their reason for existence is to move Scotland away from, well, to break Scotland away from the United Kingdom and to establish Scotland as a sovereign country. And in September of 2012, there was a referendum on that very issue, and 55% of the population voted in favour of remaining within the United Kingdom, 45% voted against. And that put the issue to bed, or it was thought it put it, resolved it, for a while, but almost immediately, the Scottish National Party, in a rather bizarre way, benefited from defeat. They had their membership rolls increased exponentially. Mm-hmm. Many people thinking that the British government had duped or had misled the Scottish people, because in the run up to the referendum, it talked about Devo Max and the devolution of further powers. Mm-hmm. And we talked last time as to what devolution means, but giving more and more powers to Scotland as a concession. So right. If you stay within the United Kingdom, we will, the benefit for you is we will promise in return that we will give further powers. And I think within 24 or 48 hours of the referendum, David Cameron said, well, what I meant by that was this will happen, but it will happen at a pace consistent with the devolution of powers within England as well. So maybe looking to Melissa here, because there were proposals to devolve power not simply to Edinburgh, but also to the regions of England, where there is also a great desire, arguably, for greater economic self-control. And David Cameron said, this process of devolution isn't simply about Scotland, it's actually about the United Kingdom as a whole. Now, this is quite interesting, because the Conservative Party, traditionally, has been very opposed to this idea of devolving power from London to the regions of England, such mm-hmm. as the North East, Newcastle, Sunderland and Middlesbrough, or the North West, Manchester, mm-hmm. or the South West down in Devon and Cornwall. And you might think, well, we're just a very, very small country. But we're a small country with 60 million people. So in that sense, we have a population which is about a fifth of the United States. So mm-hmm. it's a big country in terms of population. And there's long been a feeling that once you get out of London and the southeast, you move away from the centre of the economic levers and you move to more disadvantaged areas. And the argument has been by proponents of devolution is that the way that those areas can perhaps take greater control and develop their areas, promote their areas for the better, is to give them greater devolution.
This sounds very similar to a continuing debate we're having in this country since the beginning, since before the beginning. We call it federalism because, of course, we have a federal system of government, and of course, we have states and a national government at the same time over the same geographic region, and we've had a long-standing battle for power. So people here would think of it more of the state's rights. But even within our states, we have something similar because individual towns will want to go a certain way, and we're having battles right now. For example, an urban center will want to have a pro-gay rights ordinance. Mm-hmm. But the more conservative, broader state government might say, no, we don't want you to do that. And so they'll pass a state statute that says localities can't do that. And so we have battles for control within a state. We have battles for control throughout the country as a whole. And so what's happening both in the European Union and in Britain itself is very similar, I think, and very understandable to American ears. But let's turn to Melissa now, because you represent part of, at least, one of those local areas. Is this something you'd like to have? Would you like to have a little more devolution?
I think we should, yeah. We're currently in the council as well going through a vote about it, mm-hmm. About to have a Northeast combined authority, which is bringing together a lot of cities in the Northeast to bring power away from central government to give the whole area more control of things. I think we should have it.
Sounds like you're going to form your own state up there. Is that what you're talking about?
Not quite a state, but the arguments are probably quite similar to the federalist arguments and things mm-hmm. like that. But I think we should definitely have more power from people in the area who actually know what's going on in that area rather than someone far away that isn't going to be aware of the issues.
If I can just cut across, one of the long-standing arguments has been that there's been underinvestment in new infrastructure in some of these large metropolitan cities in the north of England, so mm-hmm. Manchester, Liverpool, Newcastle, Leeds and Sheffield. If they'd had greater self-control, then more money would have been invested in particularly new road and rail. So we are talking here about large sums of money. We're not just talking, no disrespect to what you were saying a moment ago about statutes on mm-hmm. social issues, but actual spending on physical capital that would help transform those economies, which are behind London and have been behind London for many, many years. As I say, the argument is essentially that when it comes to the division of the cake, London always seems to do better than the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. Now, the counter-argument to that is it's the capital, so
maybe it should.
Maybe it should. And, of mm-hmm. course, the other argument from an economic geography point of view is that London is a more successful region. And if you believe in a free market, actually what's been happening is that we have these centrifugal forces in the United Kingdom where people are increasingly moving to the southeast mm-hmm. and moving away from the north. But the interesting thing at the moment politically is that, as I said a moment ago, is the Conservatives now under George Osborne, who's the Chancellor, who is very much the champion of seeking to reverse this process and give greater autonomy and greater devolution to the city regions. The introduction, for example, I think Melissa was talking earlier on about the 800 mayor, but the mayor in Newcastle at the moment, if I'd be correct in saying, Melissa, is essentially a ceremonial honorary role.
Yes.
But it's not the mayor in the way that you use a term, which is really a city manager or mm-hmm. a political figure who would be a champion of a region. Now, Labour and then later the Conservatives are very, very, very interested. We've been interested in American mayors for about 30 years. There was a chap called Michael Heseltine, who was a maverick within the Conservative Party who believed in these sorts of issues of giving greater devolution to regions. And he was very impressed when he came over to the United States in the 80s and saw the powers that mayors had and their ability to galvanize the business community and other communities within localities around, get a coalescence around, certain agreed economic principles or economic programs. And there is now a desire, I think, increasingly to have that same function in the United Kingdom that would allow places like Newcastle really to be a shining beacon for the Northeast and Manchester as well. And as I say, the ability to spend very large sums of money on new road and rail infrastructure and energy infrastructure and so on.
Very important. And again, very, very familiar. And in fact, I was smiling while you were talking because just earlier this week, there was a great conclave up in our little town where my law school is in Grundy, Virginia, which is in southwestern Virginia, which is the most economically deprived region in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but arguably much of the United States. It's a very depressed area right now, especially with the decline of the coal industry. And that was the whole purpose of it. It was local political leaders coming together from both the local and the state level. And basically the message was, we need more money to be invested in this region. And that's typically the message that local legislators take with them to Richmond, our state capital, every year. We want a bigger slice of the pie. We want more roads. We want more infrastructure. We want more, you know, digital infrastructure, whatever it is. So yes, that's exactly what happens here. And in fact, I think pretty much every session of our probably every state legislature in the United States is simply dividing up the pie. And the more power you have regionally, the more pie, or as we like to say, the more pork you can bring home. So you'd like to bring some more pork up to Newcastle.
Yes, we would. We'd like some more pork in the Northeast region, definitely.
Now tell me a little bit about the region. We've all heard the expression, that's like taking coal to Newcastle, right? Was it a coal-producing region?
Yes, it was. Yeah, and the Northeast, places like Middlesbrough was a big steel industry, and we've seen in the recent months things like that have been dramatically cut, so there's no sort of trade and things in
and
the
this
area.
Is how this all relates, forgive me, but now I'm remembering. Apparently, you've only got a relatively small steel industry left.
Yeah.
And the steel industry has been suffering, it says, because mm-hmm. of the dumping of Chinese steel on the market. But thus far, the European Union has refused to sanction the Chinese for this. And right now, it looks as if much of the remaining steel industry in Britain may be shut down. And so that's probably enhancing people's anger at the EU. Did I get that right?
That's broadly correct, that though mm-hmm. Britain has been the British steel industry, which is much smaller in terms of employment, but I think in terms of output, it's probably as big as it was, particularly in the high quality steels in mm-hmm. Sheffield, the stainless steels. But the British steel industry has been a victim of international dumping, and because of membership of the European Union, there is very little that the United Kingdom can do to prevent that, mm-hmm. and that's a perfect illustration of the opponents' argument against the European Union, that it removes that important sovereignty, that ability to take control of your own economic future. And it's not just the steel industry. The British car industry was a victim of that at one stage as well, although it was a victim of perhaps it was more a case of suicide with the British car industry. But there have been other industries which have been the victims, as I say, one may just say that they're the consequences of globalization.
Right.
And, the other way of saying it, of course, is that Britain has benefited from being a member of the European Union in that there are many Japanese car companies now. Honda and Toyota are both in Britain with large car plants, and that they've invested in the United Kingdom, so goes the argument, because it provides a gateway into the rest of the European Union. So they have built very large plants, one of which is in the northeast of England at Sunderland, mm-hmm. and that's the Nissan plant. There's a Toyota plant in Derbyshire. There's a Honda plant in Wiltshire in Swindon. And these are very, very large plants. And those companies contend that the reason that they're in the United Kingdom is because Britain's membership of the European Union provides a gateway without paying import duties. Mm-hmm. So it provides essentially a taxless way of moving cars or selling cars within Europe. And so that's a case of where Britain has benefited immensely from membership of the European Union.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the midst of a really, really interesting discussion with two people from Britain, Melissa Davis, a city councillor from Newcastle, and William Walton, who is a law professor in that same city at a place called Northumbria University. We're talking about Brexit. And though there are lots of constitutional issues, it's also frequently about trade. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with William and Melissa. Stick around.
We'll be right back.
And now it's time to finish our discussion with William Walton, a law professor from Northumbria University, and one of his students, Melissa Davis, all about Brexit, the proposed exit of Britain from the European Union. Or I should say, to finish as much of it as we have time for today. This is part one of two episodes we're going to devote to Brexit, so we'll try not to leave you in too much suspense when our time runs out today.
These economic arguments can sometimes get a little bit obscure, but they are extremely important. These are people's jobs. This is bread and butter, as we like to say here. Very, very important things. And of course, regardless of the policy issues, and you can make arguments on both sides, the real constitutional question is who has the power to make the decision? And that's why the people in Sheffield are complaining so much these days. They're saying, you know, if we had the control back here in Britain to slap on some trade tariffs or some penalties for this Chinese dumping, then our industry wouldn't be in such bad shape. But we can't do it because those people in Brussels won't let us do it. And that's the power. That's the sovereignty issue. So this does relate all the way right back down to your city.
Definitely, yes.
Now, you're a member of Labour.
Yes, Labour Party.
Why don't we talk a little bit about, more specifically, now that we've tied these issues, or at least mentioned the relationship between them, how does Labour feel about the so-called exit of Britain, or the British exit, or as people say, the Brexit from the European Union?
I think, as a whole, the party's quite nervous, as the Brexit argument is going to have massive implications on the country as a whole, but specifically in our region, we've just passed a motion in council to remain in the European Union, so we definitely want to stay. But obviously, the councils as a whole throughout the country may have different opinions, so it's definitely causing a bit of a divide within the parties.
Now, Labour is the dominant party up in Scotland too, isn't it?
Not anymore.
Right, because the Scottish National Party kind of absorbed that.
Yeah. They did,
could,
yeah.
Could I just come back to Labour briefly?
Please do.
Since we last spoke, Labour has had a new leader, and that's Jeremy Corbyn.
Yes, now he's a fascinating character. Tell me a little bit about Jeremy.
Well, you have your own Jeremy Corbyn. He's in many ways, he is comparable to Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. He's something of an outsider. He's similar in age profile. I think Jeremy Corbyn has been a maverick backbencher for Labour for 30 or so years. Was a leading member of the Greater London Council going back into the 1970s, along with Ken Livingstone and who's the MP for Hackney? I'm looking to Melissa.
I'm not sure.
But anyway, we'll come back to that. Mm-hmm. And Jeremy Corbyn, after Labour's very, very bad defeat in the election last year of 2015, all of the parties, apart from the Conservatives, lost their leaders almost immediately. I think I mentioned to you last time that the UK Independence Party lost its leader, Nigel Farage, but he then resumed his position. He wanted to step down, he stepped down, and then they asked him to come back, and he went back. But Labour lost its leader, the Liberal Democrats lost its leader, and Labour then had essentially an open primary. There was a party rule which said, which had been put in place by its previous leader, which was Ed Miliband, which was that the next leader would be selected essentially at large by the members rather than by the MPs. And in order to be a candidate, a prospective candidate had to secure 15%, I'm looking at Melissa, I think, of the MPs' endorsements. So I think there were about 225 Labour MPs because their number was reduced. And there were three or four candidates, and Jeremy Corbyn asked MPs, so look, I'd like to be a candidate as well. And the only reason I want to be a candidate is I represent the left, and all of the other candidates are on the right of the political spectrum, and I just think it's a good thing if we had a left-wing candidate to provide some degree of spectrum, some degree of choice.
Within the Labour Party?
Within the Labour Party.
Which is already the left party.
Well, yes. Okay. But I don't think at the start when he put himself forward, there was any real belief that he would emerge as leader. And then what happened later, about 3 or 4 months later, in September last year, is that he rapidly became the people's choice in very much the same way that Bernie Sanders, extremely popular. And in order to vote in the election, you just had to pay £3, $5. So a lot of people signed up, allegedly some people from the Conservatives signed up, but a lot of people signed up who were supporters of Labour. And they really wanted, I think, a fresh start. And what Jeremy Corbyn offered was a move away from the clone politician who was more, you know, more in tune with Wall Street.
A rejection of the status quo.
A rejection of the status quo.
This is sounding so familiar.
Yes, yeah, it is. And it's not dissimilar to what's going on in your Democrat mm-hmm. Party at the moment. And Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader by a landslide. Mm-hmm. And on the European Union issue, I think it's fair to say Jeremy Corbyn's position on the European Union membership is less than clear because, as I said to you last time, the left on the Labour Party have been as opposed to membership of the European Union as the right on the Conservative Party because of this loss of sovereignty. They also believe that that is a critical issue, a fundamental issue. Mm-hmm. They don't look at it in terms of pounds, shillings and pence, in terms of, well, we'd be so many £100 each better off each year for a member of the European Union. Mm-hmm. I think to many people that's a rather tawdry argument about, you know, I'll be slightly better off if we're a member or so. These are fundamental issues of principle, which you as a right. constitutional lawyer would understand. And Jeremy Corbyn, I think, is one of these people who has long articulated the view that sovereignty, democratic sovereignty, is far more important than any economic arguments, whether they swing, you know, favourably or unfavourably. Now, the rest of the Labour MPs, the 225, generally are all passionate supporters of membership of the European Union. And in part, I think that's because the Conservatives are so split on it. Electorally, it's very sensible for Labour to have a clear position in favour of European membership. Mm-hmm. But Jeremy Corbyn's position is less than clear. And
He's
very, very cagey. And with 75 days to go, I'm still not quite clear actually what Jeremy Corbyn's position is.
Well, Melissa, you just need to bring him up and tell him to.
I'll try.
Okay, all right then.
Well, whatever, Craig, Melissa, do you know what Jeremy Corbyn's
position
is?
No, I don't. The party as a whole is very for staying in the European Union, but Jeremy Corbyn hasn't given really any clear indication.
Jeremy Corbyn's interesting. I mean, he said a number of interesting things. One that caught my eye because a particular interest of mine is national security law is that I believe he said that he would not ever use nuclear weapons if he were prime minister, which may be a very moral statement, but it completely undermines the entire theory of nuclear weapons deterrence. And so people were aghast at this. I mean, even if a prime minister secretly felt that way, a prime minister would never say such a thing. You've always got to make the bad guys believe that you will use your nuclear weapons if they attack you. Did that one statement pretty much doom his chances, however dim they already were, of ever becoming prime minister?
Jeremy Corbyn's obviously having to graduate from being a backbench MP who's beholden to nobody other than perhaps his constituents. And he's had that role for, as I say, 25, 30 years in Westminster, to suddenly leading the Labour Party with all of the responsibilities.
It's a lot different.
It is very different in terms of discipline, in terms of one of the big issues was whether there should be a free vote within the Labour Party on the bombing of Syria.
Right.
Now, that was a very, very big issue, almost a turning point for Labour. And Jeremy Corbyn's view was that Britain should not be involved in bombing of Syria. And it was Hilary Benn, who was the son of Tony Benn, one of our great left leaders of the past, not a leader of the party or a leader of Britain, but certainly one of the exponents of the left in Britain. But his son, Hilary Benn, is very much more of a political pragmatist, and he's a Labour MP. And he gave a speech to the House of Commons, which almost in an unprecedented manner had MPs clapping, which is something that doesn't happen in the House. And his speech was very much in favour and support of the government's position of bombing Syria. And it left Jeremy Corbyn in a very, very difficult position because he'd been isolated by one of his own front benches. Mm. And there was a suggestion Jeremy Corbyn may remove, because the selection of front bench MPs, by which I mean shadow ministers, is very much in the gift of the leader of the opposition party. And it was a suggestion that he would remove these proponents of bombing of Syria. But if he'd have done that, there wasn't really anybody to replace him, because there aren't that many people within the Labour Party who think like Jeremy Corbyn does. So you have a leader of a party.
It was a bit out of touch, it seems.
He was very much out of touch with his own Labour MPs, but very in touch with his constituents. So Jeremy Corbyn's powerful position is he can turn around to these people and say, Yeah, but don't forget, last September, I was supported by something like 60 or 65, 70% of the Labour Party membership in an unprecedented number of voters because of this low threshold to vote. And in that respect, he's perhaps is similar to Bernie Sanders in the sense that he can say, look, you might not like my views, but my views are very popular out there. The party might not like my views. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump can say that. The official party, the party elders may not like my views. But I can go to a rally and I can get 15, 20, 25,000 people, mm-hmm. and they love my views. So the party elders have to be very careful about turning around to Jeremy Corbyn and saying, we don't want you.
Mine is all so familiar.
Because the Labour Party members have said, well, we do want him.
Right, and we will get, finally, to very specifically discuss those people who wanted Brexit and why they want it here in just a moment. But you used a little bit of terminology that I think I'm familiar with but might be a little confusing to some people. In fact, I had the pleasure of visiting your House of Commons when I was over 18 months ago. And, of course, I've seen pictures of it and video of it many, many times on the Internet. And when you say front benchers, you literally mean people who sit in the front right down next to the big table in the middle of the room. And the back benchers quite literally are the people who are sitting behind them, sometimes all the way behind them. So there's a physical truth to what you're saying as well as a metaphorical one. And the point is that it's a lot easier to sit in one of the back benches and just throw pot shots in.
It is.
And just be critical all the time. Not to say that criticism's bad. I'm simply saying that's a lot easier task than it is to be the guy sitting up front taking all that criticism and having to try to balance all of these disparate eddies and currents through the party and, of course, the opposition, and to get actually get something done.
One of the criticisms made mm-hmm. by the other candidates, people like Andy Burnham, in the lead up to the election, the Labour election, was that in opposition in government, Jeremy Corbyn had defied the Labour whip, mm-hmm. which is the...
fellow who rounds up the votes.
He had defied the Labour whip on, I think, something like 300 occasions in the past 20 years. Jeremy Corbyn was very much a rule to himself. And you know, now he's, as I say, in charge. He's having to exercise a degree of discipline amongst others. And, of course, many of those other front benches, who we talked about a moment ago, mm-hmm. and back benches, are saying, well, I'm sorry, Jeremy, but you were very indisciplined yourself when you were...
Who's talking now.
Yeah. Why should we support you on Syria?
I absolutely. And again, the parallels are just striking because, of course, Bernie Sanders has recently gotten himself in trouble, most notably in an interview with the editorial board of the New York Times, when they asked him very specific policy-type questions, and when he had to move beyond broad principles, he seemed to lose his way a little bit and made a few factual mistakes. And I'm not taking sides here, and I'm not being, you know, I know there are a lot of people listening who are big Bernie feeling the burn people, so I'm not being critical. I'm simply saying he's encountering some of those same issues. It's a lot different to be the senator from Vermont and being critical of what's going on, and it's much harder to put yourself forward and say, okay, I want to rein in the big banks. Okay, how? What exactly do I do to do that? Or I want to do this with foreign policy. Well, how do you achieve that? And that's he's having to address those issues too. But let's put the focus back on you all again. And I know that we've spent a lot of time on labor because we have a laborite here with us, and we're very happy to have her with us. But let's talk about the Conservative Party and about UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, right? These, at least elements within both of these, are the primary proponents of the so-called Brexit. Now, what do they think they've got a good chance at this, and why are they so in favor of leaving the union?
Well, going back to overall ground, to what we were discussing a year ago, the UK Independence Party very much has the agenda of removing Britain from the European Union. And it was doing very, very well in the opinion polls in the run-up to the last election, mm-hmm. so well so that it threatened to remove a lot of Conservative MPs from their seats, particularly in the south of England, mm-hmm. and also in some blue-collar working-class areas where the Conservatives had narrow majorities. And as a response to that, really, David Cameron is... one of the arguments against David Cameron, or criticisms, is he's... His commitment to any ideology is nothing more than skin deep. So he immediately said, well, in that case, I'll promise a referendum. Mm-hmm. And that he thought would help shore up the hemorrhage of votes.
Well, he did get a good majority this last year.
He got a majority of 12, as you say, and the fact that it's a majority is for the Conservatives, given that, as we said last time, they hadn't had a majority since John Major.
So it did work in the short term.
It did work for the Conservatives.
But now he's got this referendum. Now, again, just to summarize where we went, and then he went and he said, I'm going to get us a better deal.
Yes, yeah, so he said,
give me a few months. Let me go negotiate a better deal. Some of the issues we have with immigration, for example, et cetera. Let me see if I can negotiate that with the union. And he did that, didn't he? He went over and he got some concessions from the other members of the European Union.
One of the concessions he got, first of all, most of his opponents on the right thought that the concessions he gained were absolute trivial, that they were nothing other than crumbs off the European table. He managed to get an agreement whereby I think immigrants to the United Kingdom would have to be in the United Kingdom 4 years before they could receive benefits. He also got an agreement whereby, believe it or not, there was a system whereby people who came over to Great Britain claimed benefits could send child benefit back to their children and family in other European countries. So we're essentially exporting welfare relief. And he got an agreement whereby new entrants to the European Union would only be able to, the amount that they would be able to send back would be consistent with what they would get in their own country if they claimed it in their own country, if that makes sense. So a localised rate to the Czech Republic or a localised rate for Italy. So he got those agreements, but it's thought generally that the agreements he got were not that great. But nevertheless, what he said is, look, I've got these agreements. I think these agreements are sufficient to make Britain the membership of the European Union something that I would endorse, something that I would support. And that was his position. So he went to get he said, if I go and get these concessions, I will come back, reflect upon them, and then come to a view as to whether we should stay in. Well, we all knew he was going to say we should stay in.
Right.
And he then said, if this was on the table today, I'd join the European Union. I would recommend joining the European Union. And
so I've just cut a deal, and upon reflection, I think I cut a good deal.
That's exactly it. You summed it up very well.
Okay.
And that's our show. It's not all of the interview with William Walton and Melissa Davis. There are a few more minutes left of that, and we'll pick up with that next week, and then we'll go into our roundtable discussion with even more of William's students from the University of Northumbria Law School in Britain. I think you'll really enjoy hearing from those young, fresh voices. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, or maybe even more broadly, the British American experiment in constitutional self-government.